This is Jim Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, and it's my pleasure to have with us today the former Attorney General of the United States, Dick Thornburgh, who, as both a prosecutor and a private attorney, has been heavily involved in the notion of criminalizing corporate conduct. And what I mean by that is the actions of corporate officers, directors, and corporations themselves, and how those intersect with criminal law. He's published extensively in this area, and I'm just really pleased to have him with us to talk a little bit about some of these issues. So, General Thornburgh, to start with, how did we get here? In other words, traditionally, as I understand it, corporations themselves couldn't even be held criminally liable. And this is really a phenomenon that's evolved in the last 100 years. How did we get to the situation where corporations can be prosecuted, and how should we think about that?
Well, Jim, of course, corporations are artificial entities. They're creatures of the law. They don't have any flesh and blood or personality independent of their organization. But years ago, the courts held that under the doctrine of respondeat superior, they would be held responsible for criminal conduct undertaken by their employees that was designed to benefit the corporation. And out of that has grown a substantial body of criminal law in the corporate area, nowadays becoming even more commonplace rather than relying on the traditional regulatory and administrative means of regulating corporate conduct. Increasingly, you're seeing a lot of corporations being charged criminally and in some cases destroyed by those criminal charges. The poster child for that, of course, being Arthur Andersen in the WorldCom case.
So when we're looking at abuses here, and you've certainly been a critic of some of the abuses, should we focus more on the prosecutors and abusive prosecutions, or should we focus more on the legislature for drafting laws that enable the prosecutors?
In terms of federal prosecutions, with which I'm most familiar, I think the blame has to be shared. Congress has now extended the criminal law as it affects corporations far beyond where it has been up until a recent past. And the drafting of these statutes is far from artistic. They leave a lot of leeway to the prosecutors, who oftentimes are looking for major targets out there, and they will, in many cases, in my view, twist and abuse the laws to the extent that they are stretched far beyond what their original intention was. I've been personally involved with cases where I think that has come to pass, and of course the corporation pays an enormous price. Nobody likes to be branded as a criminal, particularly when there are other civil and administrative remedies that are available and can be utilized and have traditionally been utilized. So I think the need here is for a tightening up of the legislation relating to corporate criminal liability and for greater supervision by the Department of Justice of what individual U.S. attorneys are doing in the way of prosecutions.
Well, the criminal law, as opposed to the civil law, and of course there's at least artificially a lot of distinction here, has had traditionally a lot of protections that the civil law didn't have. For instance, the grand jury, the reasonable doubt standard, and traditionally, at least in the common law, concepts of intent or mens rea. A number of critics have said that some of these substantive protections have been eroded over the more recent years. Is that correct?
I think there's a great deal of concern about what the application of mens rea or a state of mind, whether you find an intentional violation taking place, how that applies to corporations, and often the effect of that is to read it out of the particular offense involved, and you're left with almost absolute liability. In fact, there's some prosecutors and regulators who have been bold enough to say just that, and particularly in the environmental field. And I think it is very important from the point of view of the average citizen to keep in mind what the difference in consequences is between a criminal charge and a civil charge. A civil charge, of course, can produce back-breaking penalties. There's no question about that. Some of the fines that have been levied, some of the judgments that have been obtained in civil cases are substantial. But they don't have the devastating effect that a criminal conviction has of a corporation or any of its principal officers. And that's why traditionally criminal law has been reserved for the most egregious cases, the most serious types of threats to our society, and the civil and regulatory apparatus been used for normal violations that occur on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I certainly would agree with you that there's been substantial abuse in the civil arena as well. But I also think that you raise a very important point that there are a lot of collateral consequences to criminal prosecution that go beyond the civil arena itself. So what can corporations do to protect themselves here? You see a increasing influence of compliance programs to try to keep corporations compliant with the law. How do those work, and do they work to protect corporations and their officers?
Increasingly, more corporations are creating a separate independent compliance capability to undertake a constant process of assessing the risks in the business, not from the point of view of business risk, but from the point of view of legal risk. What kinds of exposures are corporations likely to have to both criminal and civil law, but in particular criminal because of the devastating consequences of criminal prosecution? That kind of activity has to be taken seriously. Occasionally you'll find that a corporation adopts a compliance process that looks good on paper, but it's not actually utilized, and that, of course, can be an even a more serious consequence, as the prosecutors may want to use evidence of that to indicate that there's no serious intent to deal with violations of the law.
So I guess the other major area, or one of the other major areas you hear a lot of attention being focused upon is in the area of the attorney-client privilege. And in particular, under the Thompson Memorandum and other memoranda emanating from the Justice Department, you may wish to comment on the notion that corporations will get better treatment from the government if they waive the attorney-client privilege, which of course could implicate individuals at the company as well as the corporation itself. How should we think about that issue? And I realize you've written extensively on it, and this is just going to be a very capsule summary.
Well, it's a very tricky issue. About 10 years ago, now Attorney General Eric Holder, who was then the deputy, issued the first set of guidelines for corporate prosecutions that included a provision that would give credit to a corporation for cooperation if they waive the attorney-client and work product privileges. Now, that sounds awfully technical, but basically what that means is that the attorney-client privilege, which is one of the oldest privileges in the law dating back to Elizabethan times, is designed to ensure that those who would give legal advice to clients do so on an informed basis, so that anything that's conveyed in discussions between the lawyer and the client are privileged and not subject to discovery and can't be compelled as testimony. With the erosion of that privilege by the very aggressive implementation of the Holder Memorandum, the Thompson Memorandum, and the McNulty Memorandum, and now the Phillip Memorandum, Department of Justice has gone through a number of iterations on this. There's a great deal of uncertainty as to when, for example, you're conducting an internal investigation on the part of a corporation, what kinds of advice must be given to employees of the corporation who are being interviewed, because the privilege belongs to the corporation, not to the employee, and yet no employee wants to be viewed as being non-cooperative with his employer's investigation. So that it's now in a pretty sad state, and there is legislation in the Congress that would roll back this rule and retain the attorney-client privilege, but it's moved very slowly, and in the meantime, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of jeopardy of this important privilege.
Well, that's all we really have time for right now. Our listeners should stay tuned for further coverage of an event we've got going on at the Manhattan Institute involving Dick Thornburgh with Ken Langone and J.P. Donlan of Chief Executive Magazine discussing these issues. That'll be posted on our website as well. It's my pleasure to have the Honorable Attorney General Dick Thornburgh. This is Jim Copeland. You can check other podcasts at our Manhattan Institute webpage, www.manhattan-institute.org, or our legal web magazine, www.pointoflaw.com.